This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of fracture healing from the basic science section on orthobullets.com. Starting with a quick summary, fracture healing involves a complex and sequential set of events to restore injured bone to the pre-fracture condition. Stem cells are crucial to the fracture repair process, and the periosteum and endosteum are the two major sources. Fracture stability dictates the type of healing that will occur. The mechanical stability governs the mechanical strain. When the strain is below 2%, primary bone healing will occur. When the strain is between 2% and 10%, secondary bone healing will occur. The modes of bone healing include primary bone healing with the strain less than 2% and secondary bone healing with a strain between 2 to 10%. Bone healing may also occur as a combination of the two processes, depending on the stability throughout the construct. Primary bone healing is also known as intramembranous healing. This occurs via haversian remodeling and occurs with absolute stability constructs. Secondary bone healing involves responses in the periosteum and the external soft tissues. This is also known as enchondral healing and occurs with non-rigid fixation, such as fracture braces, external fixation, bridge plating, and intramedullary nailing, amongst others. Giving a few examples of the types of fracture healings with treatment techniques, cast treatment would be considered secondary bone healing, occurring by endochondral ossification. External fixation would also be considered secondary bone healing, and occurs by endochondral ossification. This is also true of IM nailing, which demonstrates secondary healing and occurs via endochondral ossification. On the other hand, compression plating provides primary bone healing via haversian remodeling. To delve further into secondary bone healing, we will describe the stages of fracture healing, which go through inflammation, repair, and subsequently remodeling. The inflammation stage of secondary bone healing begins with hematoma formation, which provides a source of hematopoietic cells capable of secreting growth factors. Macrophages, neutrophils, and platelets release several cytokines. These include PDGF, TNF-alpha, TGF-beta, IL-1, IL-6, IL-10, and IL-12. These cytokines may be detected as early as 24 hours post-injury. The lack of TNF-alpha, as is seen in HIV, results in delay of both endochondral and intramembranous ossification. In this stage, fibroblasts and mesenchymal cells migrate to the fracture site and granulation tissue forms around the fracture ends. During fracture healing, granulation tissue tolerates the greatest strain before failure. In this inflammation stage of fracture healing, osteoblasts and fibroblasts proliferate. The inhibition of COX-2, for example via the use of NSAID, causes the repression of RUNX2 and osteric, which are critical for the differentiation of osteoblastic cells. Moving on to the repair stage of fracture healing, primary callus forms within 2 weeks. If the bone ends are not touching, then bridging soft tissue callus forms. The mechanical environment drives the differentiation of either osteoblastic or chondrocytic lineages of cells. Osteoblastic cells are formed in a stable environment, whereas chondrocytic cells are formed in an unstable environment. In the repair stage of healing, endochondral ossification converts soft callus to hard callus or woven bone. Medullary callus also supplements the bridging soft callus. Cytokines drive this process, driving the chondrocytic differentiation, and cartilage production provides provisional stabilization. In the repair stage, type 2 collagen, or cartilage, is produced early in the fracture healing process, and then followed by type 1 collagen, or bone expression. Again, the amount of callus is inversely proportional to the extent of immobilization. Primary cortical healing occurs with rigid immobilization, such as compression plating, whereas endochondral healing with periosteal bridging occurs with closed treatment. The final stage of secondary bone healing is remodeling. The remodeling phase begins in the middle of the repair phase and continues long after clinical union. In the remodeling phase, chondrocytes undergo terminal differentiation. This process involves a complex interplay of signaling pathways, including the Indian hedgehog, or IHH pathway, parathyroid hormone-related peptide, or PTHRP, fibroblast growth factor, or FGF, and bone morphogenic protein, or BMP. These molecules are also involved in the terminal differentiation of the appendicular skeleton. In the remodeling phase, type 10 collagen types are expressed by hypertrophic chondrocytes as the extraarticular matrix undergoes calcification. Proteases degrade the extracellular matrix, and cartilaginous calcification takes place at the junction between the maturing chondrocytes and the newly forming bone. Here, multiple factors are expressed as bone is formed, including BMPs, TGF-betas, IGFs, osteocalcin, and collagens 1, 5, and 11. Subsequently, chondrocytes become apoptotic, and VEGF production leads to new vessel invasion. Newly formed woven bone is remodeled via organized osteoblastic and osteoclastic activity. This reformation process is shaped through Wolff's Law. Wolff's Law states that bone remodels in response to mechanical stresses. Remodeling is also dictated by the piezoelectric charges of bone, which dictate that bone remodels in response to electric charges. The compression side is electronegative and stimulates osteoblast formation, while the tension side is electropositive and stimulates osteoclasts. We will now discuss a number of variables that influence fracture healing. These include internal variables such as blood supply, head injury, and other mechanical factors, external variables such as low-intensity pulsed ultrasound, bone stimulators, COX-2, or radiation, and various patient factors including diet, diabetes mellitus, nicotine use, HIV, and medications that affect healing. Starting with discussion of the internal variables, we will start with the discussion of the blood supply, which is the most important internal variable. Following fracture, we initially see the blood flow decrease with vascular disruption. After a few hours to days, the blood flow increases. This peaks at 2 weeks and normalizes at 3 to 5 months. In the discussion of blood supply, it is relevant to discuss unreamed nails. Unreamed nails maintain the endosteal blood supply, whereas reaming compromises the inner 50 to 80% of the cortex. Looser-fitting nails thus allow for more quick reperfusion of the endosteal blood supply versus canal-fitting nails. Other internal variables that may influence fracture healing include head injury, which may increase osteogenic response, and other mechanical factors that would include bony soft tissue attachments, mechanical stability and strain, location of the injury, degree of bone loss, and the pattern of fracture, especially important in segmental fractures or fractures with butterfly fragments. In these fractures, there is an increased risk of non-union, likely secondary to the compromise of the blood supply to the intercalary segment. Going over the external variables that influence fracture healing, the first external variable to discuss is low-intensity pulsed ultrasound, or LIPUS. With LIPUS, the exact mechanism for the enhancement of fracture healing is not clear. It is likely due to the alteration of protein expression, elevation of vascularity, and the development of a mechanical strain gradient. LIPUS accelerates fracture healing and increases mechanical strength of callus, including the torque and stiffness. The beneficial ultrasound signal is 30 milliwatts per centimeter squared, pulsed wave. Healing rates for delayed unions and non-unions have been reported to be close to 80% with LIPUS treatment. Moving on to discuss bone stimulators, there are four main delivery modes of electrical stimulation. They are direct current, capacitively coupled electrical fields or alternating current, AC, pulsed electromagnetic fields, and combined magnetic fields. Direct current decreases osteoclast activity and increases osteoblast activity by reducing oxygen concentration and increasing local tissue pH. AC current affects the synthesis of cyclic AMP, collagen, and the calcification of cartilage, and pulsed electromagnetic fields cause calcification of fibrocartilage. Bone stimulators lead to elevated concentrations of TGF-beta and bone morphogenic protein. Regarding the role of COX-2 as an external variable, COX-2 promotes fracture healing by causing mesenchymal stem cells to differentiate into osteoblasts. Regarding radiation, high-dose radiation causes long-term changes within the remodeling systems and diminishes cellularity. Various patient factors are important to discuss at this point as well. Again, the relevant patient factors that we will discuss include diet, diabetes mellitus, nicotine use, HIV, and medications affecting healing. Regarding diet, nutritional deficiencies, especially those of vitamin D and calcium, can impact bone healing. As high as 84% of patients with non-unions were found to have metabolic issues. Greater than 66% of these patients had vitamin D deficiencies. In a rat fracture model, protein malnutrition decreased fracture callus strength, and amino acid supplementation increased muscle protein content and fracture callus mineralization. Related to the topic of diet, we will discuss patients with gastric bypass surgery. Calcium absorption is affected because of duodenal bypass with Roux-en-Y procedures. This leads to decreased calcium and vitamin D levels, as well as secondary hyperparathyroidism and increased calcium resorption from bone. These patients should be treated with calcium and vitamin D supplementation. Notably, this is only seen with Roux-en-Y procedures, and gastric banding does not lead to these abnormalities because the duodenum is not bypassed. Moving on to discuss patients with diabetes mellitus. Diabetes mellitus affects the repair and remodeling of bone. There is a decreased cellularity at the fracture callus, delayed endochondral ossification, and diminished strength of fracture callus. Fracture healing takes 1.6 times longer in diabetic patients versus non-diabetic patients. Regarding the use of nicotine in fracture healing, nicotine use decreases the rate of fracture healing. It does so by inhibiting growth of new blood vessels as bone is remodeled. There is an increased risk of non-union, with an increased risk of pseudoarthrosis in spine fusion by 500%. Diminished strength of fracture callus is seen with nicotine use, and smokers can take 70% longer to heal open tibial shaft fractures versus non-smokers. In patients with HIV, there is a higher prevalence of fragility fractures with associated delayed healing. Contributing factors to this include antiretroviral medication, poor intraosseous circulation, TNF-alpha deficiency, and poor nutritional intake. Finally, we will review several medications affecting bone healing, including bisphosphonates, systemic corticosteroids, NSAIDs, and quinolones. Bisphosphonates are recognized as a cause of osteoporotic fractures with long-term usage. Recent studies demonstrated longer healing times for surgically treated wrist fractures in patients on bisphosphonates. Long-term usage has been associated with atypical subtrochanteric and femoral shaft fractures. Moving on to discuss systemic corticosteroids, studies have shown a 6.5% higher rate of intertrochanteric fracture non-unions in patients taking systemic corticosteroids. Regarding NSAIDs, prolonged healing time is seen because of COX enzyme inhibition. And finally, quinolones, which are toxic to chondrocytes, diminish fracture repair. Now that we've gotten a general overview of this topic, let's review a few questions to see how this material has been tested in the past. Question 1. A 42-year-old healthy woman presents to the emergency department with a comminuted distal tibia fracture. She undergoes open reduction internal fixation with a bridge plate construct. Which of the following is true regarding this procedure? 1. Fracture fragments must be cleaned and aligned anatomically. 2. It relies on endochondral bone formation through chondrocyte proliferation and hypertrophy. 3. It relies on endochondral bone formation through the development of cutting cones. 4. It relies on intramembranous bone formation through chondrocyte proliferation and hypertrophy. Or 5, it relies on intramembranous bone formation through the development of cutting cones. The correct answer is 2. It relies on endochondral bone formation through chondrocyte proliferation and hypertrophy. This patient presents with an extra-articular distal tibia fracture and undergoes bridge plating. This method of fixation relies on endochondral bone formation through chondrocyte activity and secondary bone healing. Fracture healing relies on complex interplay of biochemical and mechanical factors and can occur through intramembranous or primary bone healing or endochondral or secondary bone healing. Primary bone healing relies on anatomic reduction, compression, and very little strain at the fracture site to allow for haversian remodeling or the development of cutting cones. Absolute stability constructs lead to primary bone healing. Alternatively, secondary bone healing occurs in the periosteum and soft tissues in slightly higher strain environments. Relative stability constructs such as intramedullary nails, external fixators, and bridge plates are examples of fixation that rely on secondary bone healing. Perrin reviews the biological and mechanical properties of bone remodeling and the complex interplay of patient, injury, and surgical factors that influence healing. The use of relative stability fixation techniques allows for bone to overcome the initial excess strain at a fracture site and build a scaffold that brings the strain to a more reasonable level. The author stresses the importance of understanding bone biology to select optimal implant and methods for surgical fixation. To review the incorrect answers, answer 1 states fracture fragments must be cleaned and aligned anatomically. This is incorrect as this is usually required for primary bone healing. Answer 3 states it relies on endochondral bone formation through development of cutting cones. This is incorrect as cutting cones are seen in haversian remodeling during primary bone healing. Answer 4 states it relies on intramembranous bone formation through chondrocyte proliferation and hypertrophy. And answer 5 states it relies on intramembranous bone formation through the development of cutting cones. Both of these answers are incorrect, as intramembranous bone formation occurs during primary bone healing and would not be present in this case. Next question. During fracture healing, granulation tissue tolerates the greatest strain before failure so that the mature bone can eventually bridge the fracture gap during healing. What is the definition of strain? 1. Amount of force an object can withstand until plastic deformation is lost. 2. Change in length over original length of an object due to an external force. 3. Relationship of stiffness to time-dependent loading. 4. Force intensity over volume. Or 5. Force intensity over cross-sectional area. The correct answer is 2. Change in length over original length of an object due to an external force. A strain is defined as the change in length over original length, L, and is created by a deformation of a material from an applied force. The mechanical environment at the fracture site has a major influence on fracture healing. Granulation tissue can withstand higher strain, which stabilizes the mechanical environment and forms a scaffold on which cartilage and bone eventually form. This occurs after strain decreases incrementally. Optimal healing, however, depends on the duration, rate, timing, and type of mechanical influence. Bone is formed by osteoblasts that are adapted to the very low strains of over 1% change in length. Osteoblast synthesis and proliferation is stimulated at uniaxial strain of between 0.3% and 2.8%. It is known that limited interfragmentary movement of 0.2 mm to 1 mm is optimal for fracture healing, resulting in promotion of callus and increase in rigidity. Excessive motion, on the other hand, prolongs fracture healing. Researchers have identified that tissue strain of 2% is suitable for primary bone healing, and secondary bone healing takes place at tissue strain of 2 to 10%. Strain of 10 to 100% results in fibrous tissue formation and 100% strain to non-union. This is known as Perrin's theory. Stokes published a review article on the effects of stress on bone healing and growth, and notes the importance of the Hüter-Volkmann law in bone growth. The Hüter-Volkmann law states that growth is retarded by increased mechanical compression and is accelerated by reduced loading in comparison with normal values. Stokes also notes that sustained compression of physiologic magnitude inhibits growth by 40% or more, while distraction increases the growth rate by a much smaller amount. To review the incorrect answers, answer 1 states, an amount of force an object can withstand until plastic deformation is lost. This is incorrect, as this describes the elastic limit or yield point. Answer 3, the relationship of stiffness to time-dependent loading, describes the time-dependent deformations caused by creep and shrinkage and have an answer effect on the stiffness or modulus of an object. Answer 4, force intensity over volume, is the definition of force density. And finally, answer 5, force intensity over cross-sectional area, describes the definition of stress. Last question. Type 10 collagen expression by hypertrophic chondrocytes is characteristic of which of the following aspects of fracture healing? 1. Inflammation. 2. Granulation tissue formation. 3. Cartilage callus formation and calcification. 4. Bone deposition. Or 5. Bone remodeling. The correct answer is 3. Cartilage callus formation and calcification. There are 3 phases to fracture healing. The first is the reactive, then the reparative, and finally the remodeling phase. The reactive phase is characterized by inflammation and granulation tissue formation. The reparative phase is marked by cartilage callus formation and bone deposition. Finally, the bone deposited during the reparative process is remodeled during the remodeling phase. Type 10 collagen is a homotrimeric collagen found in hypertrophic cartilage that is expressed during the cartilage callus calcification phase of fracture healing. After fracture, inflammation and clot formation occurs, where type 1 and 2 collagen are found. Type 3 collagen is expressed by fibroblast, and type 5 collagen is found in areas of fibrous tissue formation. In the soft tissue callus and chondroid phase of bone healing, types 2 and 9 collagen predominate, with type 2 being deposited in areas of mature cartilage production and type 9 stabilizing the fibrils of type 2. In the callus calcification phase, type 10 collagen is expressed by proliferating chondrocytes as the extracellular matrix undergoes calcification. In the osteogenic bone deposition phase, there is a progressive shift from primary to secondary spongiosa, and type 1 collagen predominates. That is all for this review about fracture healing. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. Keep in mind that these podcasts are designed to go along with the topics on orthobullets.com, and in fact, you can listen to these episodes right on the OrthoBullets website or via the mobile app while going through the topic. If you've gotten any value from the OrthoBullets podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Also, if you are not already, please be sure to follow OrthoBullets on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube for daily high-yield content. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you all tomorrow, right here on the OrthoBullets podcast.